Welcome to Intimate Interactions, your personal relationship study guide. From the stories of how we're told we're supposed to love, to how we've learned to process through difficult emotions, no intimate topic is too big. This season, we talk about how intimacy intersects with jealousy, addiction, body image, shame, and much more. Let's talk. Special thanks to my amazing Patreon supporters for making this possible. If you want the ad-free version and you'd like to support the show, go to intimatepodcast.com and click premium, or go directly to patreon.com/Victor Salmon. Either way, you'll unlock every episode of this weekly podcast and gain tons of additional premium content. Hello, intimates. Have you ever wondered what life might look like if you grew up in a different culture? Would you have the same religion, values, cultural beliefs, relationships? It's amazing how much of our lives seems to be chosen, while it might be more circumstantial than we'd like to admit. Today, Starship Jones, a mixed-race relationship anarchist from Mexico, offers his perspective on relationships. I ask a few questions about his relationship with Professor Meow, the hierarchical polyamorous guest from the episode Hierarchy, and just as monopoly relationships are possible, so too can hierarchy RA relationships thrive, though in both cases not likely without complication. We talk about hierarchy, polyamory, relationship anarchy, gender, and much more. We briefly get on the topic of Bill C-16 while discussing gender, as we both enjoy sidebar conversations. As promised, later in the session, I've included the link to read the one-page Bill C-16 that received royal assent, meaning it is already or will shortly become the law. In my view, it's excellent legislation, and if you don't agree, please read the one-page bill itself before coming to an opinion. It has been said to criminalize far more, in my view, than it actually does. A lot has been suggested, in fact, about it that I believe to be false, and I'm confident if you read the legislation itself, it'll start to become clear how few changes it actually makes and how much wild and, in my opinion, inaccurate speculation there has been about how those few changes will be applied later as precedence becomes available. And, of course, if you disagree, as you are invited to do so respectfully, please feel free to leave comments on the Intimate Interactions Facebook group, or if you're a Patreon supporter, please feel free to have the discussion on the Patreon page. And in case you're keeping track, this is the first episode I've done with a partner of a guest from a previous episode. And on that note, let's go to the session with Starship Jones here on Intimate Interactions. Welcome to another session of Intimate Interactions. I'm here with my guest, Starship Jones. If you recall Professor Meow from the last episode, Starship Jones is one of Professor Meow's partners. He's a queer, pansexual, mixed-race 32-year-old man. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be on here.
Yeah. Should I just call you Starship?
Yeah, that works.
Spaceship. Spaceship. I seriously feel like every time I think of that, I think of the Lego guy from Lego Movie. The, like, 80s guy.
Oh, yeah.
He used to build the spaceships.
Yeah, that's pretty relatable.
Cool. So, let's dive right into it. So, we were talking just a little while ago about alternative relationships, and I was curious if you could chat a little bit about your relationship philosophy. Like, what kind of relationship do you practice, and is it a relationship you're in, or is it more of an identity for you?
Yeah, for sure. I find that the more that I learn and kind of get into this, the more the labels themselves get blurred as to what I can actually call what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I've always enjoyed the term relationship anarchy, because that kind of helps me more understand what I don't want, rather than what I do want.
Sure.
It also kind of helps keep a lot of the pressures that normal labeled relationships can tend to have, especially in a poly situation.
Sure.
I stay away usually from terms like primary and secondary, simply because I don't like calling a secondary partner secondary.
Right.
Right. It
feels relegating almost.
Yeah. Yeah. It starts to go into the realm of like comparing and a certain hierarchy that I don't fully appreciate.
I empathize very much with that. I relate very much with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as an identity, I suppose so. Like it's something that I've been practicing for pretty much a decade at this point.
That's longer than I've been practicing relationship anarchy.
Nice.
Or really any type of non-monogamy.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say relationship anarchy has been my thing for 10 years. Sure. Just poly in itself, right? Sure. Starts with open relationships and you're curious and could this work? And then, you know, sure. a few failed relationships later, you're like, I think I get it now. But yeah, it's inherently, I think, an identity in the terms that I couldn't not be poly.
Yeah.
Like, I realized that I cannot be a monogamous person because I don't feel like, A, I can fulfill anyone's needs 100% all of the
time. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, nor is anyone out there representative of that everything that right.
they
want.
And if they were, to what extent would I feel like I were pressuring them?
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot to put on someone's shoulders, and it's really easy then to, like, I don't know, get your expectations unfulfilled, you know, and even having those expectations is already a bit of a hurdle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I do my best not to place expectations on a partner that they'll meet any of my needs, because I find when I do that, my interactions resemble what I see on television rather than what I feel is a very consensual interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't even called a partner like a girlfriend or a boyfriend in a very long time for those same kind of reasons. Mm-hmm. It's like we're partnered, we're kind of friends, we're kind of lovers, we're kind of just,
yeah.
Every relationship takes on this whole thing that to kind of label it as one solitary thing mm-hmm. just kind of feels wrong at this point.
I find I often think of them as like boxes or cookie cutter shapes. And it's like, these are the shapes of gingerbread people you could have.
Right.
And you're like, but I kind of want to just bake my own gingerbread yeah. person. Have it look the way I want it to look.
Yeah, exactly. You can do it without the mold. Just kind of draw outside the lines a bit, yeah. you know, give it that extra arm if you want it.
Or tentacle.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever you're into.
Sure. Awesome. Well, you just like knocked off the first three questions all in one.
Nice. Yeah, I am effective.
Or the first four even. That's great. Very effective. So we're on to the social questions about non-monogamy, which is, does your family know, and how have or would they have processed or are they processing your lifestyle, and does culture play a role?
Yeah. So I'm going to try to tackle this question as best I can.
It's a hard one.
I am a Mexican Jew, which means that I have a lot of tradition to adhere to and a lot of cultural nuances that are just kind of like there because of reasons.
Reasons.
So I have two families, the close family, which I consider, you know, my mom, my dad, and my brother. And then there's the extended family, which includes my grandparents and everybody else that shows up once in a while. The extended family doesn't know any more than they need to, because I have disappointed them enough throughout my life.
Oh, jeez.
Like, you know, we have a good relationship, but I'm definitely not married to a Jewish girl. They don't have grandkids. Right. I'm not really out here preserving the legacy.
Running around with these shiksas. What
yeah,
are you
thinking? Yeah, exactly. I have tattoos, which is a huge no-no in Judaism. So, like, I'm already not getting buried properly, cemetery,
ouch.
Which is fine.
I love how you're like, from my perspective, yeah, I really don't care.
It's fine. I don't...
Sure.
I have some, like, traditional connection to Judaism, but it's not... Mm-hmm. It hasn't been an identity of mine in mm-hmm. a long time. And then there's my immediate family, which they do know. My mom and my brother, I tell them most everything. My dad, I'm kind of pick and choose.
That's fair.
So my dad knows that I am polyamorous,
mm-hmm.
which he calls brave. So you can kind of see the difference in thinking there.
Sure.
My dad is kind of traditionally jealous, let's call him that. So, you know, like, I don't like my girlfriend talking to men, kind of.
Oh, geez.
Kind
so
of
not
thing.
Even, like, regular jealousy, but, like, flat out, like, can't have emotional intimacy, can't be distantly related to, connected to, work with, talk to.
Kind of, yeah. Like he's never been, like, violent about it
sure.
or scary or anything, but he gets moody, so enough to, you know, like, pout for weeks or, like, even break up with his partner kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's how he was raised. He recognizes it, which I guess
is good.
Goes somewhere.
Sure.
Yeah. But, yeah, so they know. I was always kind of the weird one anyway, so it's just like, oh, it's another thing. Like, you're this.
Mm-hmm.
You're poly, so, like, you have a bunch of girlfriends,
right,
I guess.
You're the black sheep that has sex with all yeah. of the black sheep.
Yeah, and then I guess, like, there's my mom and my brother, when I'm like, well, I'm not only just polyamorous.
Right.
I'm also queer.
because that's
and
a big
like,
one.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh boy, what does that mean? I'm like, eh, right. just, you know, it just means that I'm attracted to whoever I'm actually attracted to.
Right. It doesn't like, have to be someone female-bodied. It doesn't have to be someone femme-presenting.
Yeah, no, not particularly. Yeah. There's kind of like a layer of things that attract me, and intelligence is always the first one. And after that, you know, like, everybody has some sort of preference, but the superficial ones aren't important to me. It doesn't really mm-hmm. matter what a person is packing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I empathize with that.
Yeah, so my mom is great, actually. Every time she comes to visit to Vancouver, she learns something new.
That's awesome.
Last time she came to visit was last year, and she mm-hmm. met her first trans man.
Oh, wow.
And pretty much trans person.
Right.
Right? In Mexico City, we're still progressing a bit, but very slowly. So in Mexico, we still consider trans people transvestites, which is just like...
Oh, wow. So it's literally seen as like, it's just clothing, it's superficial. Yeah. Like, people don't get the whole gender identity complexity.
Not yet, right? So like in Mexico City, maybe, because Mexico City is more progressive. The rest of the country still is a bit behind. They still have to deal with poverty and religion, which are just...
Right.
You know, like they actually, most of them don't even have time to be like, I don't know what a trans person is. I don't have time to think about that, right?
Yeah, poverty is a really iron grip.
Yeah.
It's not one you shake off to learn social justice values for.
No, exactly, right? Like, philosophy is a privileged position, sure. But that's what I love about places like Vancouver. They really kind of help open your eyes and normalize things.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, it's important that a lot of people here also learn about the perspective that it's not this great everywhere, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, it's working. But I find that places like this also have that kind of, like, inherent responsibility to shine a bit brighter and be mm-hmm. like, hey, look, what happens when we actually
have all these
respect
things.
Each other and, mm-hmm. like, fucking are able to talk about
important things.
Issues. Yeah.
Things that are important to us now that we're privileged.
Yeah, and when a person can just come up to you and your thoughts aren't inherently like, oh, man, is this a person, like, a boy or a girl? Are they, like, do I call them a they? Do I call them a he? It's just like, oh, hey, you are a person, and I'm going to refer to you as a person.
Yeah.
Unless you give me otherwise, you know?
Yeah. And typically I've found people have been really, really great, certainly with me, if I've accidentally misgendered them on first meeting them.
Yeah.
Or if I have had to ask because I just had no idea. I find people respond really well to that. If you're literally like, hey, I'm Victor, I use he, him pronouns. Who are you? It like it gives them that like invitation of like normalizing, I'm giving you my pronouns because I desperately need to, you know, like, or even not that you desperately need to know theirs, but also just like, I'm worried or anxious in this social situation because I don't want to say the wrong thing.
For sure. And I think like we're in such baby stages of this whole, like, let's call it like this gender transitional revolution, if you will.
Revolution.
Yeah, we still have to ask questions, you know, and we're still at the point where like older generations, a lot of the older generations are kind of fading away, and we have this kind of like middle generation that's like, hey, I grew up with these weird values, and I'm just starting to recognize that they were actually pretty damn wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, like, unlearning takes a long time, right? And so I think, yeah, it's good, and it's really nice that people respond well to accidentally being misgendered or confused or whatever. Especially if one isn't trying to just be a douche about it and be like, no, I think you're this, so this is what I'm going to call you.
Oh, it's so douchey.
Yeah.
It's just unnecessary. It's like, let people choose the names and pronouns and whatever that they want for themselves. Yeah. It doesn't seem like it's hard to me.
It's sad, I think, because it's most people, I think, that behave like that are just like closeted narcissists. Where it's like, it's not about you, you know? And I know it's hard sometimes to understand that life isn't about you, but that person...
That's been hard for me to accept.
Yeah, right?
No, I think that's a human thing. Like, it is really hard to accept that, you know, when someone says something about themselves that has nothing to do with you, but it challenges a core belief of yours. That's really hard.
For sure. Like, even I find myself, like, with the they-them pronoun, for example, sometimes I'm like, right, you're talking about one person. I was still kind of, my brain assumes it's a group of people. So they're like, they did this. And I'm like, wait, how many people did you? Oh, right. No, it's just this person. Right. I'm getting there, but it's still, right, because you're born, growing up, there was no such thing as a they pronoun.
Right.
Nobody was a they.
Right.
You know, if anything, they were kind of like somewhere in between genders.
Right.
And when I was growing up, those words, you know, like words like crossdresser, transvestite, things are right now, you're like, haha, maybe those words aren't that great.
Right.
For this reason, you know, like we can still have people out there that are crossdressers, but it's like a crossdresser does not tie into a person's gender or right. identification.
Certainly
or
not their identification or their, like, gender yeah. identity, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's great, you know, like, I think it'd be nice to move forward and eventually live in a world where labels are just not as important and it yeah. doesn't really matter.
Spoken like a relationship anarchist.
Right, yeah, yeah. I think for me, one of the things that still gets me, it's like when, say, Professor Mew will go on a date with someone.
Okay.
You know, and she'll come back and be like, oh, this person was great. And so she'll go out on a date with a non-binary person.
Sure.
So it's a bunch of they, right? Like, right, right, they right. did this and they did this. And then I'm like, ah, oh, how can I ask you to describe this person?
Right, in a like, way that isn't microaggressive to their
yeah, yeah. It's like, because it's like, I don't want to know if they have breasts, but, like, I want to be able to picture this person in my right. head, right? Like, so how do you... And it's one thing that I'm still like, okay, there's obviously, you know, like, oh, they had green eyes, they had a beard, they had this build.
Right, right.
You know, but you still have, like, those nagging thoughts in the back of your head. It's like, oh, these little things that I'm unlearning. Why am I curious about
right.
what
how significant is it?
Sorry, yeah.
Sure. I mean, it's a little different, I suppose, if you're like, this is a person who may be interested in being a unicorn at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you're kind of like, I'm curious for other reasons. But if it's literally yeah. just someone who's dating only your partner or yeah. someone who's just a friend of your partner... It is interesting how much we key to those secondary sexual characteristics
yep.
and, like, gender expressions that are just so ingrained. They certainly are in me as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's interesting, and I personally really enjoy the process of unlearning a lot mm-hmm. of the things. It's quite something. You know, sometimes that you have to go through a bad moment in order to get them, but sometimes it's good, and it'll just kind of, like, little thing just click in your head, and you're like, oh... Mm-hmm. Oh, right. I can hear the voice of my grandparents speaking to me. That's what
totally.
Okay, I'm going to correct this behavior.
Yeah.
Now.
all of the shame that I was just experiencing comes from, and yeah. I finally have a location for it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I did an episode with Gloria Jackson Nefertiti, who's a shame specialist.
Mm.
It was really cool.
Nice.
Yeah, I think that was actually the one before Professor Meow, so it was two episodes ago.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll have to let you have a listen to it.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be great.
That's pretty good.
I do have a very interesting interest in shame, because shame is a very...
Totally.
It's quite a powerful feeling.
Yeah, it is. Well, and especially yeah. coming from conservative cultural traditions of various different kinds.
Yeah.
Trying to live in an alternative space that's already not expressly approved of
yeah.
outside of the immediate bubble of Vancouver proper
yeah.
Makes it really hard when you start introducing all of these very traditionally associated with shame... conservative type cultures.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You know, like, most of the world out there is inherently shamed into mm-hmm. what it's like, whatever you, it doesn't even have to be sexual or anything. It's just sure. like, oh, you want to, what do you mean you're a woman and you want to drive? Shame, you know? What do you mean
right.
you're a man and you want to cry? Shame. What do you mean you're mm-hmm. this person and you want to this, you know?
This person and you want to this
yeah,
is very well.
Like, what do you mean you want to exist? Shame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
that's probably the best quintessential, like, expression of shame. What do you mean you want to exist? Shame.
Yeah, shame on you for wanting to exist.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's often how it feels. Like, I think when shame gets used, people have this idea that they're just normalizing you,
yeah.
that they're somehow helping you find this sort of, like, center, the,
yeah.
like, balance point in society where, like, you'll be safe there. Like, I think when parents and family do it, sometimes,
yeah.
they're genuinely trying to keep you safe and being like, if I just remind this person now privately how shameful what they're doing is, they won't be shamed by people outside of the family and it'll be easier. But somehow it's so much harder when family shames you versus when someone outside does.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And, you know, like, I'm sure I've been shamed for saying something bad about a person. And that's like, yeah, okay,
sure.
that's
sure.
you should be a little shamed about that. You
There's
know?
A healthy amount of shame where
yeah.
you're just like, well, maybe not shame, but guilt at least.
At least, yeah, a little
at
bit.
At least
yeah.
a healthy amount of guilt of like, oh, I did something bad. That
yeah.
kind of sucks. I'll do my best not to do that in the future.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if you see your picture in the newspaper carrying a tiki torch sounding racial slogans, you should be ashamed of that, you know, like... You can grow as a person, but it will require
funny.
For you to be a little shame.
That's funny.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people who would agree with you.
Yeah.
And the whole, like, Charlottesville, like, wow. Just
yeah.
wow. The fact that that's even alive at all today, like, blew my mind when
right?
I first
so,
saw
yeah,
it.
So, yeah, so that's where I think, like, I mean, not to get fully into it, but I think
sure.
America or the States is a great place to be like, shame is being diverted into the wrong things, you know, like,
interesting,
America's shaming like little kids for thinking they're trans or gay. It's like, right. No, you're not, you're too young, how
but
dare,
saying da, da, da. There are some very nice people on both sides,
yeah,
of that,
exactly,
conflict.
But then at the same time be like, no, this is free speech, you know, like, I mean,
right, like,
your
freedom,
shame is
freedom of verbal expression, yeah. Trump's freedom of what you wear,
yeah, yeah,
which to me seems less offensive. It's like, if someone says something, I guess it's just as immediate to my perception if someone says something or if someone wears something. It's like,
yeah.
I look or I hear and I know what they're communicating.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, I believe in free speech and all, but
yeah.
Like, there are people out there that really shouldn't talk.
Like, it's there's definitely hate speech as well.
Yeah.
And one thing I really love about Canada's laws versus the US laws,
right,
is the provisions for hate speech. Not that it's criminal on its own, but that if someone commits a crime and there's hate speech accompanying it, it's not a hate crime.
Yeah, no, cool. And I think that's good. You know, it's unfortunate that we have to come to situations like that.
Right.
But yeah, inherently, like, we have to sometimes still teach ourselves. It's like, no, this is wrong, you guys, and we're gonna get smacked until we learn,
right,
that this is not right.
And for my audience, I'm not an expert on Canadian laws. Don't quote me on that. Feel free to Google it and fact check me and post an angry comment on my Patreon and be like, "What are you talking about? This
Chapter
is not how our laws
says,
work at all."
Yeah.
Well, it's actually really great because Open Parliament has literally like all of our laws just online.
Oh, nice.
So you can just Google, like, when people were arguing me on Bill C-17 being, yeah, I think it was C-17? C-16?
Was it C-16? Remind me which one that was?
It was the one Jordan Peterson was all up in arms about. I can Google it really quick because accuracy
is that
important.
That's something to do with education, I think?
No, it was gender neutrality added to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, like someone
Bill
like,
C-16.
Like
it was
Jordan, C-16. Jordan Peterson, you know, he's someone that's like, you should just shut your mouth. Like, I'm not saying that like he's not a smart person or that
sure.
he's necessarily like this super hateful person. I don't know him.
Totally.
But every time he opens his mouth, it's just like, wow, man, like you're just, are the past, you know?
That's a great way of summarizing Jordan Peterson, is that he is the past.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he's popular, because there are a lot of conservative people in Canada who are genuinely not understanding what's happening. And it's scary. Like, if you think about how upsetting it can be for some person if they have a very rigid perspective on the world, and all of a sudden a non-binary person comes along and is like, hi, like, I don't know, my new chosen name is like Rexar, and I use they, them pronouns. They'd be like, you frighten me. Like, I don't know how to deal with you. I don't know how to use language. I'm afraid people are going to start calling me a homophobe or transphobic.
Yeah.
Some of them don't even know the word transphobic. It's like, so like, this is all new to them. And it's like an assault on them almost in their perspective. Or at least this is how I've had it explained to me.
Yeah. And again, right, it becomes that kind of like, it's all about me and this person like going out there and living their life and I'm never going to see them again.
Right.
But
like,
I know that there's a they out there somewhere in the world, like threatening me somehow.
Right. Somehow threatening my ideas of how the world goes together.
Yeah. It'll affect my kids. You know, like, how will it affect your kids? It's like, I might turn
I'm sure,
it's like it right. won't. If your kids are gay, they're already gay, man. Like, they'll just figure it out later.
Yeah, it's not like legislation ever prevented that gay population from being a thing historically, continuing.
Yeah. And historically, like, straight people have produced the most gay people, so I don't, you know.
That's one of my favorite arguments, is like, you should blame straight people because all the gay people seem to come from them.
Y'all raised them. Like, I don't know if, you know, and they're not out there being afraid of what they are, so.
Yeah.
So you think you did wrong, but I think you did right.
That's funny. Yeah, Peterson's a really interesting conversation point, because a lot of what he says, to me, is openly hateful or misogynistic, but he also says a lot of things that other people have said that you can't really argue against. Like, he says things like, stand up straight, and I'm like, yeah, it's good for posture, but it's not original. It's not like it's one of his original thoughts. He just also says that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, he sounds like he would have been great on the debate team in 1990, you know, when you're figuring terms out, and he's like the counterpointer, and you're like, okay, but at the same time, his rhetoric really does feel like it doesn't match with the way that at least the Western world is kind of moving and progressing, right?
And he represents all those sticks in the mud that are like, we don't like the way society is progressing.
He does, yeah. And like, I'd be amazed if someone like him believed in things like evolution, because I'm like, how then can you explain or be so against our actual evolution? Because we are evolving, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the first steps of a new type of evolution. We don't know what this is going to look like 50 or 100 years down the road, you know? Like,
I mean, if you mean in more of a metaphoric sense, then absolutely.
Even in a
Like in a biological sense?
Even in a biological sense,
because,
well,
I mean,
like,
these people have always been here, like, right? Yeah. There have always been non-binary folks.
For sure, but even with more, like, the more accepted and the more free it is, the more they're going to be allowed to fully explore mm-hmm. what it means, and the more mm-hmm. the world will be able to be like, what does a non-binary world sure. actually mean, right?
Which would be awesome. Have you seen the papers on theybies?
No.
There's a small group of parents across the United States that are raising gender-neutral children where they aren't disclosing to the children what their gender is or should be.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, why should they? Like, other than making them conform to a specific gender. I mean, ultimately, they're like, if you want to play with a toy, let me know and we'll get that toy. If you want to wear pink or blue or whatever color, let me know and I'll get you that color. Because, I mean, people are so privileged now in a lot of parts that they literally just have money for whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you can afford to buy pink clothes or blue clothes, why couldn't you afford to buy either pink clothes or blue clothes, depending on what your kid wants, instead of what you think they should have?
Yeah.
It just puts more choice in the child's hands, and you end up with people mixing and matching more gender and expressing, you know, themselves rather than conforming.
For sure.
So it definitely teaches a sense of individualism that I can see some conservatives being like, this is too individual. It's going to create a generation of narcissists and, like, all these other arguments that we hear every time kids have more than we do.
Yeah, no, it's so unfortunate, too, because it always, again, it just boils down to, like, what am I going to call your kid? It's like, well, nothing. I don't want you calling my kid anything anymore, you know? Like, I don't even want you near them.
Or even if their kids do interact with your kids, just call them what they ask you to call them.
Yeah.
It's really not that difficult. Like, it's the same as it would have been before, except the kids choosing what to call them instead of me choosing what to call them. But
yeah, and even because, like, you have those like formative years, I guess, or like when they're born to maybe like 2 or 3 before they can actually talk and express, you know, like, I want this one, you know, where you're like, oh, so what are you gonna, as a parent, dress your kid in? Are you gonna put them in the pink dress, in the blue dress? Are you gonna put trousers on? Are you just gonna, like, you know, a non-binary potato sack? Like,
sure, you... non-binary potatoes. I love that.
Yeah. Right, and I think, too, like, a lot of people also need to lose just all of this obsession that, like, certain articles are for certain genders.
Totally.
You know, like, if it's a form-fitting thing, that's maybe an argument that you can kind of have with a person who's going to wear it, but that's about it.
Sure.
But otherwise, like, you know, what does it matter if the boy is wearing a dress or if the non-binary baby is wearing pants? You know,
right.
Like, it's...
I couldn't agree more. I don't understand why it's so significant to people to have to divide people like that.
Babies
into
just
groups.
Used to be bundled, you know? Like, people couldn't even afford to dress babies. Like,
also, so... I want to be really clear with the audience. I'm not against people dressing as femme or mask. I'm against people being assigned femme or mask. So, like, obviously, even if everybody were a quote-unquote baby, even if we got to a perfectly non-binary world, there would be those female-bodied people that would be like, I want to wear makeup and wear heels and wear, like, high femme and look fucking fabulous. There would also be a lot of non-female bodied people that would do that too.
It's all about, like, the energies and really what you're kind of feeling on the inside, right? Mm-hmm. You can be a man and still have your, like, feminine energy days, you know? Like,
yeah. Or even if you're just a man's man, as Zap Brannigan puts it, you can be super, super mask, be hyper mask as you want. I mean, ultimately, what it comes down to is, what do you want to present as? And I think the more we introduce choice, the more I think lots of people who are like, I don't really know, are just going to pick what they want to pick, which might just be exactly what they're assigned.
Yeah, and sometimes you just have to wear a thing before you figure out if it's actually for you or not. So, like, you can spend years being a man's man and suddenly be like, actually, I think I am a femme man, or I think I'm a trans person. And it's like, that's fine. Why? Yeah. That's not you just pick and choosing, you know, but like,
In fact, I would argue if someone goes many, many years, I mean, maybe I shouldn't even make that argument. I mean, because ultimately, again, it's just up to whatever people want to do.
I went many years as a quote unquote bi-curious straight man, you know, like, I'm kind of curious, but I'm in no way gay. And then one day, you know, you're like in a situation, you're like, yeah, I think I'm pretty gay. There's nothing about the situation that's bi-curious anymore.
Yeah, like, the curiosity is long past.
Yeah, this is that's like... Funny. You know, and it's always a road, and like I was straight for years and years, and like had that like ting of homophobia where you're like, I respect gay people, but maybe don't do it in front of me.
Yeah.
And then you get that challenge, and you're like, wait, why do I think this way?
Right. Like, I'm totally fine with people being gay privately, but why do they have to rub it in my face during a parade?
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, and you think that while you're making out with your girlfriend on a park bench, and you're like, wait, there's a lesson here.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the other 364 days of straight pride in a year.
Yeah, right?
On parade everywhere, in all of the movies, in media, yeah. Just like displayed in front of kids all the time. You see straight pride just in front of kids all the time.
Yeah, and it's nice to have it be normalized and mm-hmm. where like...
Just one day a year.
Yeah, where I'm, you know, like I really enjoy media where there are, let's call them non-straight characters.
Sure.
But their non-straightness isn't really that important.
Totally.
You know, like, the whole story yes. doesn't revolve. It's like, this is a gay person, and all the time you just have to right. be reminded of how gay
they are. Yeah. Like, everything they do has to be, yeah. like, the gayest, most flamboyant. It's like, or you could just have a character, oh, and by the way, they happen to be gay.
Yeah, they're just gay. Or, like, cool. you don't even breeze on it. They have their partner there, and nobody ever says a fucking word
yeah, it's about like, whether they're... It's just not really even needed to be acknowledged, because yeah. it's just a thing, and it kind of settles into the background.
Yeah, like, Doctor Who had some of those moments, and mm-hmm. even though if they still touch them, like, hey, we're just here to remind you that this person is gay, like, okay, thanks, I kind of noticed. But they still try to normalize it a bit, right? They have that whole future society where people are just...
Whatever,
you know, yeah. gay and queer and pan, and they just kind of, like, it's really normal. Mm-hmm. You have a bunch of, especially, like, queer characters that are there just like, ah, I like who I like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something I love about the queer umbrella, is it's kind of like, I'm just letting you know I'm not the default straight yeah. cis individual. Other than that, anything's fair game.
Yeah, and queer is nice. You know, like, I've always... I enjoy that queer used to mean inherently, like, strange and unusual. So I yeah. think that's a perfect word to have yeah. been assigned to this.
Yes.
You know, and even as it started, like, as a bad word, you know, like, we all grew up with, like, that boy's a queer.
Right. And, you know? Well, because it kind of is an othering term. It literally means, yeah. like, other than what we have a map for. Like, in the beginning, right. queer basically was synonymous with gay, because it was like, well, there was only straight.
Yeah.
And if you weren't straight, you were queer, which meant gay. And then when there was gay and straight, and I might be getting this wrong, but I think queer got used for bisexuals mostly at that time, or gay people.
Yeah, like, I grew up with it meaning mostly, like, gay people or mm-hmm. people that had, like male homosexual tendencies.
Right.
You know, like, the quote-unquote fairies and people that got were, like, you. Effeminate.
Right.
You know, so anyone that wasn't basically, like, chopping wood with an axe was just that queer.
That's such a great image of hyper-masculinity. If anyone yeah. wasn't chopping wood with an axe, it's just so good. I've chopped wood with an axe before.
See, like, I haven't.
Which is crazy, because I think about myself chopping wood with an axe, and all I think about is, like, okay, just do your best not to split your foot in half, and you're good. Yeah. It's, like, my primary concern is, like, if I don't successfully chop this wood, so long as I don't yeah. injure myself, I'm winning.
Yeah. Yeah, and then just make sure to look forlornly into the horizon every wood you chop.
That's right. Totally. It is a good feeling when you, like, do a single chop.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really rare that I would do a single chop and split wood, because I'm not, like, the burliest of gentlemen. Yeah. But if I got, like, a single chop and it was a smaller piece of wood and it just split right down the center, and just, like, there is something so enormously satisfying.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
It's, like, because it's hard. Like, you, I mean, I am a little ashamed to admit that I have missed my fair share of wood on said chops. But when you finally just nail it just right and you get the right amount of power, because the more power you put in, the less control you have over the axe.
Yeah.
I like how my podcast just turned into, like, how to chop a piece of wood.
Yeah, it's Canadian after all.
Speaking of which, we should probably at some point return to the questions.
Yeah, yeah, please, by all means. I get derailed easily.
So. I really enjoyed that, I don't even know what diatribe means now that I think about it. But yeah. I was going to describe it as diatribe, and I was like, you know, I can't think of the definition, but that anecdote, that side rant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find it's Jordan Peterson such a controversial figure that I have typically loathed him.
Yeah.
So I do my best to be extremely good about representing his perspective. One thing I learned in biomedical ethics in my fourth year of university, #privilege, is that you should always represent your opponent's argument as favorably as that argument can be represented.
Yeah, that's fair.
So that when you come up with really good counter-arguments, there's no counter-argument because
right.
you've already represented it as favorably as possible, rather than that niggling back and forth of trying to not misrepresent, because some people do that as well.
Yeah, but it doesn't come off as like an attack.
Trying to underrepresent the other side. Like, I do my best to represent as well as possible and then completely demolish his arguments.
Yeah.
Like Bill C-16, for example, is an absolutely excellent piece of legislation. It's essentially adding gender identity and gender expression to a long list of things we already don't discriminate against. So when people are talking about all of this danger of Bill C-16 and having trans-inclusive language be protected under the charter. It's like, if someone commits a crime and they're in the middle of misgendering you, it's now a hate crime.
Yeah.
That's one of the four or five provisions. But I mean, that's it. That's the entire Bill C-16. It's only about four or five additions.
Yeah.
And almost all of them are additions of gender identity and expression to things like whether you're married or not. And it's like, I would really like to see gender identity and expression protected at least as well as whether or not you happen to be married.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If your marital status is fair game to be protected legally, I think your gender identity and expression is fair to be included in that group. And I've had conversations, like sit down, calm as can be, conversations with diehard Jordan Peterson supporters where I literally have to pull up Bill C-16 on my phone and read it to them because they're sure that it's compelled speech. They're sure it's going to damage their freedoms. And I'm like, I'm just going to read to you this inclusion. It's going to take about 40 seconds. And I want you to tell me what you don't like about it. And I will literally read it to them off my phone and be like, what's wrong with that statement? And they're almost every time, I can't find anything wrong with that statement. Like, that part seems okay, but what about the other parts? That's the typical response you hear. It's like, well, yeah, that part's fine, but what about, and then you literally like, okay, I'm going to read you the next part. It's going to take 20 seconds. You read them the next part. You're like, why do you think that marital, you know, whether you're married or not, should be more protected than gender identity and expression? Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case, but there's, it's still, it's a compelled speech bill. Cool, I'm going to read you the next section. And I just methodically go through the bill, breaking it down as calmly and rationally as possible. And you don't even need skill to do this. Like, I encourage you, just Google Bill C-16 on Open Parliament and read it. It will take you less than 3 or 4 minutes. Like, it is a very, very short bill. It's an easy read. And it's not like you read it and it's dry. It's the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It's exciting in the sense that you're like, this is a technology we have to protect people, and we're doing a pretty good job of it. I don't know. That's just my perspective on it.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's nice to have it that available, you know, to people. So, like, I think that helps without helps curb the spread of fear-mongering, too, you know? Because most of these people, this is just
they don't
afraid.
Know. Yeah.
Like, oh, this is going to infringe on my rights. And I'm like, your rights to what? To, like, be homophobic? To be transphobic?
I mean, I do my best not to make that argument because you're right, but at the same time, that type of rhetoric is never heard well by, like, Jordan Peterson supporters.
No, it's not, because...
But I hear you. It is also, like, you're right to say things that are blatantly transphobic.
And that's why it's a skill to sit down and calmly explain things.
Right.
Because it's hard. Logic doesn't work with these people, right?
Well, and also you have to make a logical argument. It you can't jump to your conclusion, because if they got your conclusion, you wouldn't need to make the argument.
Yeah, that's
fair. They literally can't understand how what they're saying is transphobic.
Yeah.
So, like, even though it's obviously transphobic to you, if you just start there, they're so far away that gap never gets bridged. So you kind of have to reach towards them a little bit and being like, I can accept that Jordan Peterson says good things about traditional old-fashioned values, do the arm swing and everything. And if you sort of start with a place of like, I don't hate the person you idealize, it goes a long way to them extending you trust.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of move into, cool, let's talk about what he actually has to say. And things like compelled speech all revolve around other forms of hate speech are not compelled speech. And I don't think that using pronouns is any more compelled speech than anything else. You don't have to use pronouns at all. There's nothing compelled about them.
Yeah.
I could literally talk about what Victor's doing this weekend, talk about the food that Victor had, and never use a pronoun for Victor. And it would sound a little bit stilted, but, you know, a lot of people that are used to using racial slurs as part of their everyday language would feel stilted trying to substitute a word in. So it really isn't compelled speech at all. I find that whole argument to be pretty much trash.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's...
Yeah, no, that's a totally fair point.
But if you don't make that point, people still have this idea that there's something special about it. Another point that I make... Well, I love how I'm like, let's move on to the questions, and I'm like totally enthralled by this. But like, another point I like to make is his lawyer and him, with the very, very best of their arguments, went before the Senate, pitched all of them in a room full of highly educated people who are all, you know, I guess they were appointed because it was the Senate, but in any case, highly educated, intelligent people all decided they were full of like garbage, that it wasn't a good argument fundamentally. I shouldn't say full of garbage because that's disrespectful, but they decided it was a bad argument. They disagreed with Jordan Peterson and his lawyer, and they passed the legislation. So what does that say? Is it these two outliers, or is it that room full of people? Or maybe some would argue that they were accepting it for other reasons, but I mean... They were also all appointed. They weren't really responsible to an electorate. I mean, that's a bad thing. That's its own problem. That's a solo podcast. But the point I'm making is I think that also says something. It may not be conclusive. It may not be a decisive win in a discussion.
Yeah.
But to even just bring that up and be like, look, these arguments were already presented to people much smarter than you or me. And those people did not agree with Jordan Peterson's case.
Yeah, it's just examples of how we are, in fact, evolving. Sure. Again, whether biologically socially, or metaphorically.
Like, I mean, I tend to see it socially because I have like a very... I have a degree in biology, so like when I think of evolution, I tend to think of it in a very biological sense. But I agree with you. Society is evolving, and there would be no way for us not to be biologically evolving.
Yeah.
So, like, I agree with you that we are literally biologically evolving, but I think we're also evolving very slowly biologically. I think more of the evolution we're focusing on tends to be the social one. That's just my perspective.
Yeah, and we as humans have evolved more mentally than we have physically or, or any other way, right? So I think that's where our first steps of our next evolution are going. It's not going to be, like, necessarily these super noticeable changes in our biology or physically.
Right.
But it's definitely the way that we perceive things and evolve as a people and as a society.
Totally.
That will get there.
And that's exciting. I love seeing how much more respect and how much more freedom we have as a people.
Yeah.
Because we're allowing people who are non-binary, you know, to be out and not get beaten up in the streets or fired from work. Like, those types of freedoms are freedoms. And I think that's something people on the left and the right can agree, is that having more freedom in society to be who we are as a people is fundamentally a good thing. And it's only going to continue to create mental illness less in people who are marginalized. And just like any other group of people in society, they are the innovators, they are the entrepreneurs, they are the computer programmers and astronauts and artists that are going to really change us as a people and help build who we are and make us competitive as a society. So I think even making a strictly right-wing argument, it's hard not to be in favor of more freedoms in society.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and Even the whole, like, left and right, like, there just needs...
It's
unbalanced, because you can't just be fully left and expect things to work. And you can't, you know, you have to find a balance. So, like, the good progressive ideas that the right have with the good progressive ideas that the left have. And if they're both smart enough to be like, actually, that idea is kind of stupid, let's talk about it.
Totally.
You know, and mediate some sort of...
I think the issue
mythical
is...
mythical central party.
Right. Well, they say Canada's always been a battle for center.
Yeah.
That's what I heard growing up in school as well, that people talk about Canada being a battle for center. It's like all of the parties, when I was growing up, were trying to position themselves more centrally because the voting base was typically electing the most centrist party.
Right.
So it didn't pay to be the Progressive Conservatives when I was growing up. It didn't pay to be the NDP. It paid to be the Liberals. And that's what we saw. At least, again, this is just when I was growing up. And again, I'm not an expert on politics, but this was when Kachan was in office and we were selected as the best country to live in the world for like eight years in a row during Kachan's presidency. But that was also presidency. Wow, I can't believe I just said that. I don't know why. It must have been that I was thinking of the U.S. or Mexico or something like that. But or India or literally
that's
like...
That's so fair. Whatever title.
Anyways,
it's the same job.
My mistake. Prime ministership.
Yeah.
During the Kachan administration, though, we also had like the boom from the 80s. So we had a lot of money flowing in, which was why we paid down our national debt consistently during that period. You want the most fiscally responsible party in the, like, as far as I can tell, the history of Canadian Treasury, it's been the Liberal Party, which is not necessarily true today, and I don't want to get too much into politics, but the point I'm making is if you just look at the numbers and the facts, you can just Google Canadian public debt. The one time we really paid off public debt, it was all the Liberals 100% of the time. And as soon as the Conservatives got into office, explosion of public debt. It was like 40% or something. Wow. We went from $460 billion to like about $600 billion.
Yeah.
So I guess like 30-something percent.
Wow.
But that was when the Liberals took over again, I think. In any case, this is a question for Wikipedia, not for Victor. Let's get back on topic.
Let's do it.
Cool. So we were talking about, did your family know? How would they process your lifestyle? Does culture play a role? And then we got...
Yeah, that's how we got into all of
this. That's how we got into the cultural identities and how cultures view rights of people, really. Because ultimately what we are talking about is your right to be out. We're talking about your freedom to be out and not be discriminated against, shamed, lose your job, lose your family. So it was a relevant sidebar. As much as it seems like it was a big departure from what we were talking about, it's literally exactly what we were talking about. We were talking about your rights as a person.
The culture, yeah. And it's funny like and amazing how that changes just so much from region to region. You know,
absolutely.
Like, I've been in Canada for 10 years now. So I haven't really been watching Mexico's like evolution over the last 10 years.
Right.
But I left a place that was still very, you know, macho in its ways.
Yeah.
So It might be too much to get into, but it's a place where there's very, very specific gender roles, and you have macho, and then you have religion, and those two just make a very deadly, toxic combination of relationships in which you have, I mean, let alone, like, non-straight relationships, you know, straight relationships are complicated enough, and usually lower class ones that are even more affected by religion, you know, that they'll have, like, I don't know, upwards of 10 kids, you know, they don't believe in protection because some book tells them not to. But the husband, like, cheats on his wife, so he's got more than 10 kids all over the place.
Oh, geez, yeah.
But he doesn't allow his wife to have friends because he's the man.
But of course, so, if we, because if he allowed her to have friends, then when that husband goes to cheat, it might be his wife.
Yeah.
Got you.
Yeah, I've met some Mexicans, you know, in my life, and we've talked about poly and stuff, and I mean, this is unfortunate, and I really don't want it to sound like a generalization, but you come from a culture where, like, as a man, it's okay to cheat. It's okay to
so what advantage does poly have for you? You do that anyway in monogamy.
Yeah, and so one thing that I always try to tell a person is, like, first of all, you're not a poly man. You're a cheater.
Right.
You know, like, does your wife know about... That's the inherent difference between polyamorous and cheating. Like, does your partner know what you're doing?
Right.
Then it doesn't matter what you call yourself, buddy. Like, you know, and the second question is, picture your wife doing this and going out and talking to this girl or this guy and, like, being friends and holding hands and telling him, being like, oh, my husband doesn't know. This is just something I give myself every now and again. Like, now you feel that, like, rage inside of you, man. Like,
that's what she would feel if she knew.
Yeah. So that's the thing that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not that having multiple partners is wrong. Like, quite the opposite.
It's the lying and cheating and...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, one of the things that makes me realize that I cannot be a monogamous man was because I feel like at some point I would probably consider cheating on my partner because I'm like, I feel trapped in this relationship or like I feel this pressure like we were talking about to be,
meet all of this person's needs,
all your needs, all your expectations. And then it wouldn't even have to be a real, like, going behind your back and having sex. It's like going behind your back and having a conversation with a person.
But still
that, like, emotional...
You want that intimacy, that emotional connection.
Yeah, yeah. I mean...
And that's referred to as an emotional affair in some monogamous circles.
Yeah, right? And then... But, like, if I can't tell you about it, and if I have to do this behind your back, or, like, you don't provide me enough, but you also won't let me, like, have friends or do this, or...
And even, enough is such a loaded term. It's like, you provide me what you want to provide me.
Yeah, and exactly.
I want to be provided with more.
Yeah.
I would love to go and get that somewhere else, and it's not going to affect... in any significant way.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, poly to me has always been, like, it's about challenging yourself, you know. You can't be poly and not go through anxiety. You can't be poly and be like, life is great because I've got all these partners. It's no, it's all the time. It's
work.
At least for me, like, yeah, it's work. It's doubting yourself. It's like being like, oh my God, am I good enough for these two people? Can I juggle these relationships?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have to be constantly on top of things, you know, like I have to communicate to all my partners. Like, are my partners okay with each other? Like, what if they're not? That's another problem.
It does sound like there's a lot of anxiety and...
Yeah.
For you, it sounds like anxiety is more an issue than jealousy.
yeah, for sure. I don't do jealousy. Like, if I get jealous, then to me, that's my gut telling me, like, something's wrong and you need to explore what this is.
Yeah, totally.
Right? Like, there is a reason that I'm feeling jealous because... Yeah.
It's not about trying not to feel it. It's about, like, oh, my body's telling me something.
Yeah. I genuinely feel compersion in my poly, you know? So I love to hear about, like, say, Professor Mew's dates. Like, I love it. She'll come and be like, I had this date and we did this, or, like, we had sex, or we went to the movies, or we just, like, talked about stupid stuff. And I'm like, that's so cool. Did you have a good time? Yes. It's like, I'm so happy for you.
And provided that metamor is, like, consenting to her disclosing sexy details to me, I'm interested in that.
Yeah.
Like, I will be really... Like, if anything, that makes me feel more connected and makes me feel more fulfilled that she's off getting all of her needs fulfilled.
Yeah.
It's like, there's nothing more comfortable than feeling like a person has chosen to like, lie down and, like, not even sleep next to me every night, but, like, is sleeping next to me right now, that they love me, and that they're off having sex with other people, getting really satisfied with those other people, and they still choose to come and lie down next to me and, like, have that conversation.
Yeah, it's a great feeling, and once you realize that, like, you can give people your heart, and your heart isn't like this meter that's full 100%, and if you give a person this, you're giving them like 80%, and so you only now have 20% for another person. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you can give this person 100% of your heart and then turn right around and give this person 100% of your heart, and that really doesn't affect, like, I currently have two partners. Mm-hmm. What I feel for one of them does not take away from the other, you know?
Like, love isn't limited.
I gotta love this person, so I'm just gonna, like, stop loving you a little bit so that I can fill this meter.
Yeah, right? Love's definitely not. And to me, it's never been a limited commodity. It's like, even in most romantic, quote-unquote, don't even get me started on the word romantic, in most monogamous mainstream rom-coms, sometimes they're not sure. They're in love with two people, therefore they must not be in love with two people.
Right, yeah.
It's like they must only be in love with one of them, or they have to make a choice because there's only one slot for their MVP, and they need to choose which P that's going to be.
Yeah, and you know, it was always about that choice. It's like, you can't love these two people. You have to choose one of them. And it's like, well, why can't, if it's consensual, choose all three of them? Like,
totally.
You know, we can all be together, or we can be together with these two, or they can
be friends. If you really want to live together, just get a space that's big enough for all of the people that want to live together. So maybe you get a poly household that's four or five people, or that's four people and has expansibility for two or three more roommates, and... You know, like, that can look however you want it to look. It doesn't have to be a house that's built for two people to have a nuclear family.
No, for sure, yeah. And I do like the kind of dissolution of that nuclear family thing that's happening. It's like, family is what you make it, you know? Like, family is, in and of itself, a tribe. And a tribe can be as big as or small as you want it to be.
Totally.
I'm all for, like, nest situations where you have, like, that kind of, like, poly household.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever the agreement is inside of it, but essentially you're all... connected and relationshiped to each other in some way.
I like that.
Yeah.
100%. And even though I would say that I'm for the freedom to have the tribe that you want to have, I'm always cautious about talking about the dissolution of the nuclear family, because I don't want to make it sound like I want people to all stop having a nuclear family. Like, if people want that, I'm all for them having the freedom to go ahead and have their white picket fence, their dog, their two kids, and their two cars.
Everyone, you know, is entitled to the freedom to be who they want. Yeah. There's, to me, like, there's nothing wrong with monogamy. There's nothing wrong with that white picket fence. There's nothing wrong with, like, I want to have a wife and kids.
Yeah.
You know, as long as what you're doing isn't A, toxic, and B, like, harmful to others.
Yeah, or infringing on their freedom. Because ultimately, what I dislike is not that someone wants to live in a white picket fence with their kids. It's that they're telling me I can't live the way I want to live.
For sure.
That's what's upsetting. I'm like, you're actively infringing on my freedom to live my life how I want to live.
Yeah.
But I'm very much live and let live. I'm like, let them be, like... Orthodox, you know, traditionalist, whatever Orthodox religion suits them, and just very traditionalist, they can do that. Doesn't really bother me. I just don't want to govern from that place of religion. That's my only caveat with, like, highly traditional and, like, Orthodox religious individuals, is like, cool, like, that's 100% awesome, and I'm really grateful to have people that represent a different perspective here in my neighborhood, as it were. And maybe that shouldn't be a motivating decision-making factor in government. I just think there should be a separation of church and state. That's
there definitely needs to be one. And I think, like, religion even needs to be treated like how we want, like, our LGBT kids to be treated. It's like, if you want to give them a choice, you want to be like, hey, look, son, like, we are traditionally a Christian / Hindu / Muslim /
whatever
family.
Or all of those.
Yeah. Here are our traditions. Mixed race folks. Yeah, right? It's like, we believe in an amalgamation of all of them.
Sure.
But here's our beliefs. It would be great for us if you, like, wanted to follow them, but you make up your mind, you know?
Yeah, you have to decide what you want to decide.
That's why God gave us free will and all that, you know, if that's what you want to believe.
I mean, I don't believe that. I don't even believe that I think if you simultaneously believe there's an omnipotent, omniscient creator, you can't reconcile that with us having, like, true free will.
I know, and I'm not going to get into, like, it's like, you have free will to do what I want you to do.
Right.
Or I'm going to send you to hell.
Well, there's that in addition, but I'm just talking about even, like, free will as a general idea.
Okay,
Because, I mean, typically you can make a mechanistic argument for the universe that A leads to B leads to C, that there are these, like, rules in place as to how things function, and that therefore if you pick a starting point, there must be an end point. And the typical counter arguments you'll hear to this are things like radioactivity.
Right.
Because they seem stochastic. They're random, but predictable in general.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of things like that. Like, I believe gas law works the same way. You can't predict the way that an individual gas molecule will go, but you can predict the way that a large group of them will. So what that typically does is it throws a monkey wrench into we as mortal human beings scientifically modeling the universe. Therefore, if you can't predict, if you can't build a machine to predict the outcome of the universe, you can't, as a scientist, say that there is definitely knowledge ahead of the universe. But all of that doesn't really matter when you're talking about an omniscient, omnipotent creator, because the notion that a capital G God wouldn't understand how radioactivity works is simply specious. It's absolutely absurd. I mean, in theory, this entity supposedly created radioactivity. So, yeah. Like, don't tell me that they can't possibly predict the way radioactivity is going to work. And I understand there's a little bit of a philosophical fallacy there, that it is theoretically possible they could create something they couldn't predict.
Well, you run into that
then
whole,
they're not omniscient,
can
though.
God create a mountain he can't move, right?
But I would just say the Occam's razor solution there is he's omniscient, so by definition he absolutely can predict how radioactivity works. And as soon as you clear up all of the random elements of the universe that science can't perfectly model, you lose free will, because you have a mechanistic argument. Mm. The victor making this argument, for example, is really only built of two general categories of things. There's my nature, potentially part of my personality is genetic, right. You could say. You could say my nature is, my genes, if you believe in a soul, which I don't, then my soul as well would be my nature, because I didn't make my soul. So what about my nurture? Because that's really the only other category. Well, geez, you know, every decision made around me as a fetus, I didn't really have a say in, someone else made that. And then when I was born, any decisions I would have made as a baby from, you know, someone else has chosen a color paint to go on that wall, and I choose to look at it. Who's really choosing? It's a sum of my nature and nurture to that point. And of course, I had no choice in any of that. So ultimately, the one making the choice is crafted by elements that person didn't really pick. So you get to a point where today I make choices every day. I feel like I have free will. But ultimately, the person that I am today is making decisions based on that personality, which is entirely derived of elements I had no choice in. So ultimately, I believe we only have the appearance of free will, not free will itself. And I kind of disagree with that if there's no God, right? Because you can disagree with there being no free will if there is no God to omnisciently know all things. But the second you introduce, especially, it's the 1-2. Literally, you have an entity that knows absolutely everything about the universe and who created it, which means if they wanted me to be slightly more straight, if they wanted to change any element in the universe, they're literally omnipotent, which means it doesn't matter if the system seems too complicated to change only one detail. They're literally omnipotent, which means they can.
Yeah.
You can't make an argument that it's only, you know, unless you concede that this capital G God isn't omnipotent or this capital G God isn't omniscient. But as soon as you introduce omnipotent, omniscient creator, I'm sorry, free will goes out the window. You can't have both of those.
Yeah, that's a very fair point.
Anyways, so as soon as you said that God gave us free will, I was like, hold my beer.
Yeah.
Another totally off topic side rant, but that's okay.
It's one of the reasons I'm not religious either. You know,
but I mean, if you want to talk about things that influence shame in society and things that influence our identities as non-monogamous folks or as queer folks or any of those things, religion plays a direct role in the shame factor of that. And my dad's whole family is Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
Italy failed to do by warfare, they certainly did in religion.
Yeah, and I mean, Jewish too, you know, it's all about guilt all of the time. And it gets tiring. It does, and I think it definitely pushed me away, for sure. And it's like, I don't think I want to live my life by these rules, you know? If when I die there are consequences, I guess I'll face them, but...
Yeah.
Up until then. Yeah, I personally am an open-minded skeptic.
Yeah,
like, me too. Some things may seem super silly, and I'll be like, I don't believe a word of that. But, you know, if thing I don't believe in tomorrow popped open the universe and was like, I am
change
here,
my perspective
like,
immediately.
Yeah, you're right there, man. I can't argue with that.
Yeah. I can't argue with evidence.
Yeah, you're right there, you know.
Yeah. Yep, I can't agree more. I'm. I guess you could call me an empiricist in that sense. That I really am. Like, just show me the divinity. The second you show me the divinity, I will believe.
Yeah, I have no reason not to. If totally. It's there and you're there, and you know,
like I'm not married to being like I'm an agnostic. I'm not married to being an atheist. But the scientific method's pretty clear that if you don't have evidence to accept that there is a thing, you always assume that nothing funny is happening. That's the best way to explain it. Yeah. It's like the null hypothesis is always like there is no relationship. These two values are unrelated. Nothing special is happening. Things don't exist. Like, because things existing is something happening. Like, you're saying something is up. If someone said there may be a purple unicorn on the other side of the world, there may genuinely be. I have no evidence that that doesn't exist. Yeah,
you haven't seen it, so you might not believe in it.
Right, but I also have no evidence that it does exist.
Yeah.
And in the absence of evidence, we always conclude the null hypothesis. That's the scientific method anyway. Hey, give us cell phones and space travel. So, like, it can't be that far off.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just conclude, well, there is no purple unicorn until I see it, or until you show me pictures, or until there's been, like, you know, hoof prints that have been documented. Yeah. Anything that can build a case that there may be a purple unicorn, not that hoof prints necessarily give color, but... maybe there are purple hair fibers in the hoof print.
Yeah, a little glitter that popped down.
Yeah, I love it.
Spark of rainbow.
Rainbow poop.
Yeah. Yeah, that would do it for me.
I would see the rainbow poop and be like, well, I know exactly what this is.
I could never see the actual unicorn for as long as I lived, but I'd be like, I saw it.
I saw rainbow poop once.
It was there.
It may have been food coloring after a very interesting, like, pride parade, but regardless.
But even then, that was still a unicorn. It counts.
That's right. Oh my goodness. Man, queer culture is such an interesting and expansive topic, and you can go down so many little rabbit holes, and we're both highly distractible individuals. So the next question I had for social was, how are you better equipped socially because of your lifestyle, and does it grow you?
Short answer is yes. Like, through all this time, like, I've been of the mind, like, you can never reach a point where you're like, I have learned everything. I'm done. You know, like, that's just impossible. So all of the time, I not only, like, find myself learning new things, I find myself unlearning things or going back to past things to be like, I really thought that was right. Turns out it wasn't. And that's okay, you know? So it definitely helps me grow. It definitely helps me look at people very different ways. Just being poly... and especially, like, being open about it and being open about queerness and poly and just really not worrying too much. I find myself that I am really open about it with strangers, you know? So I'll be like, oh, this? And I'm like, well, actually, yeah, I'm kind of gay. And it's like, oh, okay. And then, like, kind of like the day goes on. It's a really good way, unfortunately, sometimes, too, to find out who are, like, good people in your life or not.
Who are your friends and who are going to be really not helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So there's definitely been friendships that have been lost. Thankfully, nothing that's been like, I was super negative and my friend turned out to be, like, a super huge racist.
Right. That's
but,
good.
Yeah, but things are like, well, I mean, we're kind of acquaintances at this point, but the way that you think, definitely with a lot of people say, like, I talk to people back home in Mexico, and I'm like, hey, look, I don't always want to be that guy, but what you're saying needs a little bit of adjustment. Like, I get that you're down there, and I get that it's not a day-to-day, right? And I forget that being up here, too. I'm like, this is a day-to-day here, and it's super normal to, like, go to McDonald's and have, like, a non-binary person serve you your fries. But in Mexico, that's, like, people will stare. People will, like, do you think that's a man or a woman, you know? Like, look at their Adam's. Like, and it's not... It's weird because it's not like they're sitting there, like, being phobic. They're just... they don't know any better, you know?
They can't process what they're seeing.
Yeah, so to them, it's still... again, we go back to, like, that's is that a cross-dresser or is it a transvestite? And it's like, there's no spectrum of, like, actually, trans is this whole thing in and of itself that goes way beyond what the person looks like or is dressing up as.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know? So I try to keep myself, like, ahead of the times, even with things that sometimes, like, you know, like, little 19, 20-year-old kids will come and be like, da-da-da, and you're like, oh, God, that sounds so ridiculous. Right. And you're like, I get that that's me being old sometimes. I get it. I recognize it, you know.
Yeah.
I've heard certain pronouns that I'm like, oh, it sounds silly to me. And that's just to me because, like, I had never, ever heard of these pronouns before.
Right.
And to associate them with, like, I'm going to call you this, it's just like... It feels goofy.
You always get those trolls, too, that are like, call me, like, I want my pronoun to be supercopter.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, that's fine. You're a supercopter, whatever, you know, like.
But also, like, what's the pronoun for a supercopter? Yeah. And they're like, supercopter. And I'm like, I feel like this person doesn't know how language works, but I will give it to you and I will use.
Yeah. Just supercopter and I went to the movies, I guess.
Yeah, so I guess it's just like using a name, right? Yeah. You just use a name in place of pronouns.
Yeah, and I mean, like, those people, like, whatever, you know, if they want to be goofy about it.
I would just go with, like, Suko as, like, a pronoun. The whole point of a pronoun is it's supposed to be smaller than, like, a full name. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I know, right?
Because I'd be cool with, like, Suko's new pronoun.
Yeah.
But then at least it's short for, like, it's not, like, anyways.
We'll get there. I digress. Language will do some interesting things. And
I think it'll naturally select, like, people will select pronouns that aren't exhausting. Like, they'll pick pronouns that are, like, less than five syllables.
I do see, like, maybe 20-ish or so years down the line, pronouns like they or them having evolved into something a bit more. I don't even know what a bit more into, but just
or
something.
Or it'll just sound more normal because you'll have grown
exactly,
up hearing
everyone
being a they, them until they're a he, her, or a he or a her, you know.
Yeah, or even like some new pronouns will be found or some new things, you know, like ultimately LGBTQ2RS will end up being just the entire alphabet and it'll just be hopefully the point where it's like it's just humans and this is just what it is and we are a species that's just constantly evolving.
I like the community as a way of like trying to address the LGBTQIA2+S, etc. 2S+.
Yeah, for sure. It works. You know, it's also kind of like keeps people from not getting, like, I get all those letters mixed up.
And that's,
you know,
and that's okay. I think what's important is that everyone's trying.
Yeah.
Like, I don't begrudge people if they mess it up. It's like, clearly they made an effort and they took a social risk of saying something and I applaud them for that. Like, ultimately, I just appreciate that people are trying and I think most queer folks I run into do appreciate that people are trying. It's less about, like, oh, they got this wrong, they're a horrible person, and much more about, like, oh, they're trying. Like, they're one of the good ones, kind of.
Well, it's such a nice social change to see people actually putting an effort, you know, instead of just, like, no, because that's weird.
Totally. I mean, hell, it's a nice social change that people don't call me a fag and punch me in the shoulder anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I will take small wins.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I play online games, so I try to I actually try to educate people on
me
there,
too. You know? I'm the, like, fool that, like, goes into the Chuck Norris joke telling chat window and is like, just so you know, here's the thing, because it's not about the person you're arguing with. It's about the queer kid at home that doesn't know yet or that knows and is like, oh God, I'm freaking out because, like, everyone around me hates me and I just hope I'm not this thing. I hope I can ignore it. Yeah. Like, it's that kid that I'm going into that chat window for. Like, I don't care about the guy I'm talking to or the girl or whoever.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I remember being, you know, early teens and actually start to getting those talks from people who are like, hey, so you know how you're going around saying, like, this is gay and that is gay? Here's let me give you, like, some history and connotations. And at first you're like, no, that's gay, you know, and then you start to, like, slowly process it, and as the years pass you're like, yeah, holy
shit, yeah.
You know, it's not the 12-year-old's fault for going around going, this is gay.
Totally.
It's just that they really don't have this understanding of what being gay means, of what that means, of when it's used like that, of why, you know, and you're always that one. It's like, I'm not saying gay people are bad. I'm just saying that thing is gay. And it's like, yes, but that's how
you're
saying.
And the implication is that it's bad because it's gay. Yeah,
yeah,
totally.
It's like calling someone, like, a pussy or girly. It's like, why is that, you know, why is being girly a bad thing? You know, like, so I try to go online and often
try and find, like, the funniest or most grotesque way to shock people into changing their behavior. So if someone's like, you're such a pussy, I'll be like, you take that back, I'm going to come menstruate all over your face. Like, I'll say shit like that. And maybe that's problematic and not a great way to approach it. But when you're doing online gaming, like, it is, I seen some shit is the way that I approach it. I'm like, you come out of that and it's like, I mean, I don't want to trivialize war veterans, but, like, it is an emotionally toxic nightmare sometimes. Like,
oh yeah,
some of those gaming environments are like, but at the same time, if you use gaming to connect with your friends in real life and you have people, like, I have people or even not in real life, but I have plenty of friends that I've made, like, just in passing, and I stay connected with them even though they live in different cities because we all jump on the same Mumble or Discord server, and we all play the same game together and we talk and we just, like, catch up and we game together, and it's this wonderful communal experience.
Yeah, it is, you know, and ultimately, like, gaming is a community. It's it's unfortunate right now, and I hope it'll evolve with time into something better, because it's a very toxic community, unfortunately. It's full of I mean, its downside is that it is online, so you have that anonymity protecting you. I don't think most of the people on there would say the things they say.
Right.
Were they, like, physically there in front of you with their name?
But it's changing with some smarter gaming platforms, because now you can report usernames.
Oh, yeah.
And if they get reported enough times, they get temporary banned.
Yeah.
So it's like, but that's all you need. You just need a slap on the wrist. You just need visibility, because as soon as they know someone's looking, all of a sudden, a lot of the anonymity goes away.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. And it's a good start, definitely. And it always feels good when you kind of start to get people to, like, understand. Be like, oh, yeah, like, I'm sorry I called you gay, or I called you a faggot, or I did the thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if only we could get to that place.
Yeah.
Where everyone was just like, yeah, I have seen the error of my ways and will be just respectful of you as a human being. Because really, I'm not asking much.
Yeah.
I'm asking, like, us to put slurs behind us and just acknowledge each other and respect each other as human beings. It's like, I don't even care if that person's horrifically homophobic and doesn't like my lifestyle. They can believe whatever they want to believe. Yeah. I just don't think it's fair for them to say it.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I'm a person who will defend free speech much as I can.
For sure. I guess that sounded pretty negative.
No, not at all. But especially with comedy, right? Comedy's always been a huge thing for me. And comedy always has, or feels like it sometimes has, that license to go a little bit farther, you know?
I'm just going
to
adjust your mic.
Yeah. And I think comedy's a really good place to figure out where the things that you're saying are actually hurtful,
right,
or whether, like, a joke is a joke. You know, I've known a lot of people that are like, oh, these new terms, like, people don't think a joke's funny anymore. It's like, that's because that wasn't a joke. That was just a racist, like, slogan.
Well, and that's something that's great about comedy is if the audience laughs, it doesn't really matter whether, in my perspective, if a joke is racist and the audience laughs, that says more about the audience than it does about the comic.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, like, even touchy subjects, sometimes you gotta make a joke on them and sometimes you gotta laugh. Like, do I think, like, certain jokes are always funny? Like, no. Some jokes, like, say, rape jokes.
Sure.
They're barely ever funny. Like, and barely, I mean, like, you really have to find a very interesting moment where, like, not only is the joke gonna be funny, but it's also...
it makes a commentary.
Or... yeah, giving a message. Like, it has to have some... you can't just be like, ah, rape joke.
Yeah, you can't just touch on something highly traumatic
and
not put something meaningful into that joke. And I think at the same time, you're also fighting against most of those jokes make the survivor the butt of the joke.
Yeah.
But if you make the rapist the butt of a joke, it kind of flips the power a little bit. And I think especially if it's being made by someone who is a survivor and they're using it as, say, a way to gain power over the experience, like, that can be a, like, you could theoretically make rape jokes into a really positive thing, but again, we're talking about, like, 1%
like they're barely justifiable, you know, like, right. I definitely agree, like, a survivor doing rape jokes, like, man, that's all the power to you. You're getting that thing that essentially stripped you of your power, and you're taking its power away by making fun of it.
Yeah,
you know. But yeah, and so I think that's one thing that I'm like, yeah, let that change. Like, I don't need rape jokes in my life. Doesn't matter how funny they are. I don't need certain, like, jokes that are going to be at this, like, painful expense of either a group of people or a person or a type of thing, you know? And I'm usually the kind of be like, make fun of everything. I don't consider myself PC. I just believe in acceptance and respect.
Yeah,
you totally. Know. Mm-hmm. How far have we digressed?
A little, but that's okay. we're almost through most of the questions. I was going to ask how non-monogamy impacts the intimacy in your relationships, but I feel like we've covered that. I was going to ask why do people choose to practice it, but I think we covered that as well. I was going to ask about metamorships. Actually, yeah, let's do that question.
Okay.
Do you invest energy into metamorships, and do you find them rewarding? Like, do you ever meet any of Professor Meow's partners?
I like to, yes. The way that I've always kind of explained it is, like, I don't like to have a situation where my partners don't know anything about each other.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be friends, they don't have to be lovers, they don't have to, you know, like, hang out without me, we don't have to hang out, all of us. I do like to meet the people that my partners date or have connections with.
Mm-hmm.
And just as simple as, like, if my person is into you, you must actually be a pretty cool person.
Yeah.
So I'd like to meet you. That doesn't mean that I'm going to, like, be like, oh, let's have threesomes, or,
sure,
like,
or like police
I'm here
or...
to police you. No, I just genuinely want to meet you, you know? I mean, if I'm honest, there is always that like 1% where it's like, I also want to make sure you're not like a bad person.
Like that I'm concerned for the safety of my partner.
Yeah, yeah. In my relationships, I don't believe in like vetoing.
Yeah.
So I stay away from that for a lot of reasons. But primarily, I think that vetoing does a bit more harm than it does good, because
I think so too.
It blocks communication.
It can also rob people of a growth experience.
Yeah, for sure.
Sometimes they just need to realize that something's really unhappy or not good for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And so I believe in dialogue. Like, if ever I meet a partner of my partner's and I'm like, wow, this person's sketch, and I'll be like, this is why I think they're sketch. Maybe you're seeing something that I'm not, or maybe I saw something I thought I did. Mm-hmm. Could be a million things. I could be right. I could be wrong. Maybe talking about it, my partner realizes like, oh, wow, yeah, they are a terrible person. Or I realize like, wait, I was just wrong.
Sure.
But yeah, I like to invest into it. I will invest into it as much as my partner wants me to. If they're like, let's all go camping together, I'd be like, yeah, if the setting feels right, that's cool. If it's also something that you two want to do romantically or friendly or whatever, that's what you two want to do. I don't need to be there. I try to keep things as simple as possible. I've been through so many complicated relationships throughout the learning journey,
right,
that I'm just like, at this point, I really just try to not complicate myself, and provide the feeling that's like, you are completely autonomous and free to live your life, but I'm also not going to just be completely distant from you and like never ask or not care or like, you're always spending time with your partner or whatever.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that introduces a couple things. One, the comparison, and two, the use of always.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how easy that is.
Yeah.
So do you find metamorships enriching then?
They can be. I haven't.
That's a fair answer.
Yeah, they can be. I haven't run into a situation where I'm like, that was not enriching at all.
Sure.
But I've run into situations where like, yeah, I mean, that was okay. That was,
they're a person.
They're a person. That was cool. Like, we don't have a lot in common, but that's why they give you what I can't give you.
Or that just that they give you different things, or that they choose to get more of the same thing that I don't want to give you.
Yeah. And even like simple things like, Professor Mew and I, like, we have a great relationship. One of the things that we unfortunately don't click 100% is music tastes. we differ a bit, so to speak, and I really enjoy a lot of types of music, but very specifically, like, I like punk and metal, so I like really loud, aggressive kind of music. It's something that I can't share too much with Mew. But with my other partner, she's into all of that stuff. So we can sit down and kind of listen to that. And it's something that I can share. And so it's something that I also, like, if you have a partner that is into your tastes, like, yeah, for sure. And I kind of forgot where I was going with this, but I think they're definitely enriching. And again, they give that energy that I can't give. I think metamors also help us, like, deal with our own growth. They always help to keep things like your ego or your jealousy kind of intact. I'm all for it.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely know that there are definitely metamors I've met in the past where I've been like, you're a human being.
Yeah.
It's cool to have met you. I feel really safe and comfortable with you. I don't think we have anything really in common or that we would really need to meet again. If you want to meet again, I'm open to that.
Yeah, like, if we're there, we're there, and we'll be friendly. And we throw some parties sometimes, so sometimes metamors clash, and they're just there. But, yeah, and since I don't really get jealous, so to me it's perfectly fine if my partner kind of hugs them a little bit more than she hugs me, or, like, spends a bit, I like people to feel comfortable, and I get that sometimes, like, one of the hurdles in poly, especially if the more than two are together, is, like, how much attention are you paying this person? Like, how much attention? Even for me, if I'm hanging out with two or more partners, you get those feelings, like, oh, my God, like, am I kissing this person a bit more? Should I talk to this person a bit more? You know, you have these, like, little anxious thoughts in the back of your head.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility.
Yeah.
Just like some people don't get jealous. It's the same. Some people don't tend to get as anxious.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. And so, to me, it's... Again, it's about being simple, so... Yeah, like you said, some people are people, and some people are, like, want
to as opposed to those non-people people.
Yeah, oh, those are the worst.
Yeah, I am a fan of what I tend to do as a hinge is I wait until one of the two partners has expressed an interest in meeting the other.
Right.
And then I just make an introduction. I usually check in for consent first with the one who has not expressed an interest.
Okay.
And just being like, hey, this partner of mine has expressed an interest in, say, meeting you. Is it okay if I introduce you over Facebook?
Yeah.
In a group message, which I then leave. Just for the intention that the two of you will get together for one coffee and chat once. And see where it goes from there.
Yeah.
And typically people are like, yeah, that's fine. And then I'll send one message on Facebook and I'm out. That's my role as a hinge. I've facilitated contact. And presumably the partners I've selected are adults that are mature, that can manage their own social things and don't need my babysitting.
No, and that's nice because it gives them the initiative too to be like, how much do I now want to invest in this? Like, am I concerned? Am I jealous? Do I just want to make sure that they're
and there's person? No supervision, so they can just be themselves. And I find that metamors are often different people around their partner than when they're just on their own. And giving them that sort of authentic space where they can sort of be themselves with each other without having to worry about what I think about it. Because, I mean, fuck me at that point. Like,
metamorphosis is
really between those two people.
For sure. I feel the same way. I usually encourage just, like, hang out at least once. Like, go out and like, have some tea or, like, hang out in someone's house. Like, just hang out for, like, 2-3 hours.
Yeah.
And then you either never have to see them again
or
whatever, you know. But as long as there's that communication and openness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the big one, is just having the feeling that a metamor is open to talking to you. It's like there's a lot of safety that comes with that. And I think some people, myself included, manage feelings of unsafety or jealousy or concern with just open communication.
Yeah,
just it's knowing that I can meet someone for coffee and be like, hey, how's it going? Like, it's been like 6 months since we caught up. I just wanted to sort of check in with you and see how things were going.
It is, yeah. And I mean, it's always interesting. My other partner, not Professor Mew, she was going out with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And this, like, we had met him before, and they met, like, kind of in one of our gatherings or outings or something. And they kind of hit it off and started, I don't know, I guess dating would be the word here.
Mm-hmm.
And then so he started to have kind of like an issue, or just like, I don't understand how, you know, you and her relationship is.
Right.
Like, we're kind of started something, so what does yours look like? You know, like the typical things that start to come with anybody who's new to poly.
Mm-hmm.
I should add, he was completely new to poly. Like,
got you.
Never had a relationship like this before. And so, you know, he asked to talk to me. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. So I went over to his house and we had a conversation. Essentially, to me, it was like, I'm not here to threaten your relationship with my partner. Like, I'm actually rooting for it. I think you're a great guy. You are actually, in this term, kind of like boyfriendy material.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I can't really give my other partner at the moment. So that would be amazing, you know, like, because that's something that also she wants, you know, and you guys can kind of have that and feel that. And it takes some of the pressure off of me, that self-imposed pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we had what I thought was like an amazing conversation, like completely like cards on the table, being, you know, like, you shouldn't be jealous. I'm not here to threaten your relationship. I'm not here to police it. Like, you and her thing is your thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can hang out if you want. We can do all the things. And I'm like, but just, you know, so you know about me, I don't do jealousy and I don't play games. So as long as you don't really
want to do any of those things, just like be open.
Yeah, and so, you know, like, a little later, that unfortunately turned into his insecurities were too much to handle, and so started with the bit of like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with you, my partner, hanging out with him privately, me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when it's like,
so he started saying he wasn't comfortable.
He
with
wasn't
your partner
comfortable
hanging out with you privately,
right? My partner and I have been together for about 7 months,
right?
And they have been like, this was a 3-week relationship. So it's like, okay, this is an interesting point, because I really don't want to be an asshole.
Right.
But also, remember that part about me not playing games.
Yeah.
So here's bluntly, like, no.
I'm not going to stop seeing you.
Yeah,
because
like, unless my partner comes to me and goes like, hey, this is what I want.
Yeah.
I got to respect that.
Of course.
But I'm not going to let you come and be like, directly, oh, you can't see him and I'm jealous and like... You know, some of his insecurities were like, why doesn't she feel about me like she feels about you? And I'm like, that's easy, because I have invested 7 months into this relationship.
And also just different people.
Yeah.
Like, different humans with different everything.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, and I have gained her trust, and I have like worked at this and like been with her, and we've had good times and bad times.
Yeah,
and you're a 3-week relationship, and it's not a diminishment of your relationship. It's just a 3-week relationship.
Yeah, you guys, when we were 3 weeks, we were probably in the same place.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like you don't really know each other yet. You know, the trust is building, but it's not 100%. And you can't force someone to just look at you like someone who has been in a long-term relationship.
Right. Like, if that's how you've gotten security in the past, that is not going to look the same in a non-monogamous relationship as it looked in monogamy.
Yeah.
So, like, if what made you feel secure in the past was complete 100% devotion, you're not going to find that in the same way, at least.
Yeah, exactly, you know? And, like, I'm like, she's not really going to... She's a polyamorous person, too. She's really not going to, like... break off pieces of herself for you.
Yeah.
And I really don't say that. Like, I know that to a non-poly person, this always sounds so aggressive, you know, because it sounds like threats. It's like, she's not going to do this for you. And but it's like, it's just, it's not a threat, and it never is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's never even aggressive. It's just a lesson that we've all, every poly person that I know has learned this lesson.
Yeah.
Like, I've never actually met a poly person that it's like, my first poly experience was so great and we're still together. You know, to me, it's usually like my first poly relationship was an experiment that went down in flames. Like,
That's
I love that person, but it was just like,
I'm actually kind of an exception to that.
Yeah, well, that's nice. Yeah. Well, you're my first then.
You know, in fairness, I did things in my first poly relationship that looking back, I'm like, I don't know how the relationship didn't end in flames.
Yeah.
But I had an amazing partner who was really like, I mean, they were pretty new to non-monogamy, and they were like, they rolled with the punches. They just like, they were a total boss. Like, in hindsight, I'm like, my first poly relationship went well in part because I had an incredible partner.
Nice. Yeah. And that's important too. You know, like, I must have gone through at least like two of them to really like two of them that were like, oh, okay. So, and it's not that they ended because things were bad. It's just, the polyness, it just, that relationship wasn't meant for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the
occasional people that like, I think I'm poly, and then they find out, when a person finds out, you know, they try to be poly and they find out they aren't, sometimes it can be painful to watch.
It's kind of the worst to quote unquote try out poly.
It is.
Because it's like, you've had a lifetime of education on how to be monogamous. You've seen the movies, you've read the stories, you've been coached by parents, mentors, you've had the role models. You have an education of decades, potentially, of monogamous training of how to do monogamy. And you have exactly zero in polyamory, other than seeing cheaters in movies, which isn't polyamory. So
yeah, no, not at all. There isn't good resources out there. Mm-hmm. Even for me, like, it took a few years before I got my hands on any like real good resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first thing that I got my hands on that was like, ah, this kind of like explains what I've been feeling but unable to like actually process or speak, was the book More Than Two.
Yeah.
Right? And I recommend that book to so many people all of the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it might not be for you, but this book, like, what I love about it is that you can, like, you're like, you have a question, and you look at the index, and there's a chapter for that exact question that you had. And so you can just flip to it and be like, oh, okay, so that's what that means. That's what my feelings mean.
Or at least it gives you a map to try and explore it, because often you don't even have a map. You're like, I'm having a general feeling related to a thing. I don't know what I'm feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's nice. I appreciate, you know, that it's been more... I mean, I hesitate to call it mainstream, but it's been a lot more accepted, you know? And there's a lot more people now, especially young people, that are just, like embracing this non-monogamous kind of culture, whether they're just exploring it, you know, or whether they're truly, like, dedicated and feeling it.
Right.
But it's nice. When I first moved to Canada and I would tell people, like, first, like, I didn't discover the word polyamorous until maybe, like, 5 years ago.
Sure.
Right. So 5 years prior, that whole time being here, and I was like, I'm open, I guess was the term. Mm-hmm. So people would either construe that as A, I was a swinger, which I'm really not.
Right.
Or B, like, I am just this guy who wants to go around like having sex with as many people as I can. Which again, I'm not. Like, I'm not really gonna turn down a lot of sex, but I'm not actively like, I'm poly so I can have all of these partners. Like, because poly takes a lot of work. Like, having that many partners would drive you crazy.
Yeah, people like, have this like misconception that if you're in polyamorous, you must not be investing much commitment or time or energy into partners. Yeah. And it's like, you've completely misunderstood.
Yeah, like, no. It's I live on a calendar. Like, you don't get it. Like, it's not as sexy as you think it is.
Like, I could not live without Google Calendar.
Yeah.
My relationships would not function.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just as complicated as monogamy. It just has a little extra things added to it, you know, but it's still,
and some things taken away, like with the exclusivity taken away, in some ways people might say poly's a lot easier, but then you also have scheduling, and you do management, you do relationship management on a different level. You do a little about the same or a little less for each partner, and then you just have more partners you do it with.
Yeah, like, right, like, which is like I advocate for poly, but I'm like, it's not for everyone, and what's right is what works for you. If really, like, the effort to be monogamous is what you want, and your heart truly wants to be loyal to this one person forever, man, like, all the power to you.
But it may not be the person you're currently with.
Yeah, yeah, that's always the hard truth to realize as well, you know, like...
And you can be monogamous with a polyamorous person, but then you do all the work of being polyamorous, and you don't date more than one person, which is also okay.
Yeah, no, that's fair, and I, from the bottom of my heart, I commend all monogamous people that are dating poly people, because...
Yeah, that's challenging.
That, yeah, I have had a monogamous partner while I was poly, and unfortunately did not last.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were together for 2 years, but ultimately I had to break up with her, because once you realize, like, you're actually hurting this person, you know, they're trying to be okay with your other partners. They're trying to be okay with you, like, cuddling or having sex. You know, you they ask you, like, how your night was, and when you tell them, you can see the hurt in their eyes. So yeah, it's just this kind of like, so you're like, I'm hurting you, and I know that you want to be poly, but you're not, you know? And
yeah, I mean, I do my best to just let people be experts of themselves.
Yeah.
But if you see someone and you're pretty convinced they're lying to themselves, that's...
Yeah, you know,
that's hard to sit through, and you may not consent to wanting to sit through seeing that kind of emotional
pain. It is, and, you know, to me, it's like, you know, I don't know what the future holds. Maybe one day we'll meet and you'll be poly in life when we... Or something, you know. I also don't have expectations for any futures, but it is like, all I know now at the present is that I'm actively hurting you by being poly. But if I stop being poly, I'm going to be neglecting a part of myself, and you're just gonna be with someone who is not really themselves,
not their whole self, completely.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, relationships are hard, and they're hard work, and they're complicated, and they're awesome, and they're annoying, but. Like,
what a great bookend for a session on non-monogamy. That's fantastic. Well, I think we should wrap the session there. Thank you so much for all of your time, Starship Jones. I almost called you by your real name.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening, Intimates. I hope you got something out of it. The background music is Molten Snow by Jesse Spillane. Special thanks again to my Patreon supporters who make all of this possible. Thanks for your time, and talk to you soon. Appendix. Remember all those learning resources we talked about? Here they are. More Than Two, a book and audiobook by Franklin Vo and Eve Rickert, is one I have loved and have purchased for most of my partners. I recommend it as a book for absolutely anyone practicing non-monogamy. One of my partners lost the copy I lent to her when she lent it to one of her other partners, who kept it to lend to one of his other partners, and I have never gotten it back, and I'm okay with that. While the book meanders a lot, each chapter is themed, and while some blow through the book quickly, saying it's somewhat repetitive, others stop each chapter and work diligently where they're stuck, recommending the book highly to others. Useful for monogamy, this book shines for those who are considering or practicing open relationships or another form of non-monogamy.